This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Richard Russo, is best known for his books Empire Falls, which was adapted into an HBO series starring Paul Newman, and Nobody's Fool, which was adapted into a film starring Newman and Philip Seymour Hoffman. We've lost both those great actors, but the characters they portrayed in Nobody's Fool have been revived in Russo's new novel, Everybody's Fool. It's set in the late 90s, 10 years after Nobody's Fool, in the same fictional, economically depressed, working-class town in upstate New York. The character Sully, who was played by Newman, was described by Russo as a case study underachiever, who is now in his early 70s and finds out he has a heart problem. Doug Raymer, who was a cop portrayed by Hoffman in Nobody's Fool, is now the police chief, a promotion that has resulted in boredom, frustration, and a few extra pounds from sitting behind a desk. Richard Russo spoke with Terry last Monday.
Richard Russo, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with a reading from the first paragraph of your book.
Hilldale Cemetery in North Bath was cleaved right down the middle.
Wait, I'm going to stop you right there. I love that you're starting with a cemetery. So just take it again. I just want to point that out.
Okay. Hilldale Cemetery in North Bath was cleaved right down the middle, its hill and dale sections divided by a two-lane macadam road, originally a colonial cart path. Death was not a thing unknown to the town's first hardy residents, but they seemed to have badly misjudged how much of it there'd be, how much ground would be needed to accommodate those lost to harsh winters, violent encounters with savages, and all manner of illness. Or was it life, their own fecundity, that they had miscalculated? Ironically, it amounted to the same thing. The plot of land set aside on the outskirts of town became crowded, then overcrowded, then chock full, and finally the dead broke containment spilling across the now paved road onto the barren flats and reaching as far as the new highway spur that led to the interstate. Where they'd head next was anybody's guess.
Richard Russo, thank you for reading that. That's from the opening of Richard Russo's new book, Everybody's Fool. The cemetery is kind of a focal point in the book. I'm always interested in what cemeteries mean to people and whether they want to be buried in one, whether they visit relatives in one, whether they feel particularly connected to the people who they visit in cemeteries when they're in the cemetery, you know, if it helps connect them to the past and to their loved one. And since you spent a lot of time in the cemetery in the novel, I'd love to hear what your relationship to cemeteries is. And if your parents are in cemeteries, if you visit them a lot there.
Actually, despite the amount of time I spent in Hilldale in this novel, I spend almost no time in cemeteries myself. I've tried on occasion to summon whatever it is that draws other people that I know and love to cemeteries. In the past, when I've gone to visit the gravesite of people that I dearly loved in life, my grandfather is buried in the public cemetery in Gloversville, New York. My grandmother, right next to him, they were extraordinarily important people in my life when I was growing up. My grandfather bought a house, you know, not because he wanted to own a house, he had never even thought of that before, but because my mother and I were going to need a place to live, and he bought that house, and my mother went off to work every day, and I spent time with my grandmother and grandfather. They were wonderful people that I think about a lot and have written about a lot. But when I've gone to visit their gravesite, I just feel like an idiot.
Why do you feel like an idiot?
Yeah, I do. I mean, because I feel much closer to them, writing a story about them that reminds me of them. I feel like I'm bringing the best parts of them back to life, the parts that I love the most. And whether it's visiting Menemsha Harbor, where my mother's ashes are scattered, or underneath the flagpole in the Veterans Cemetery in Gloversville, Johnstown, visiting my father's grave, I just don't feel like he's there. And if he's not there, then of course I am an idiot. I'm a fool.
So in Everybody's Fool, you return to characters from Nobody's Fool. Paul Newman starred as the character of Sully, the main character in the movie adaptation of Nobody's Fool. Philip Seymour Hoffman was the police chief, Doug Raymer. Well, he was then police officer, but in the new novel, he's the police chief.
Right.
And Paul Newman and Philip Seymour Hoffman are both gone now. They're both dead. And I'm wondering how that affected your ideas about your own creations, about those characters. For people who've seen that movie, you know, Newman and Hoffman kind of define those characters. You wrote those characters without knowing they'd ever be cast in those roles, but still you must have been affected in some way by seeing them embody the characters you created.
So, of course.
So I'm just interested in what it's like to revive those characters after the actors who portrayed them are gone.
Well, it's both an exhilarating and a very melancholy experience, as you might imagine. I mean, I made three movies with Paul Newman. There was Nobody's Fool, of course, and then he played Max Roby in the HBO miniseries of Empire Falls, and we did a detective movie together called Twilight as well. So, you know, Paul and I weren't intimate friends or anything like that, but I had a great deal of affection for him, and I like to think that he was fond of me too. He would always call when a new book came out, and he'd say, "Hot shot," and I'd know it was Paul. He would say that by way of hello, "Hot shot." Good book. So there was a personal relationship there. And you know, they say about actors owning a role, and I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I think Newman owned that role. And when I heard him, because he didn't physically look like the man that I had described in Nobody's Fool, but when I saw the movie, I heard him say my lines and realized that he had found things in that character that I didn't know were there, which means, of course, that I now share proprietorship or ownership of that character with Paul Newman. And he would later, of course, do the same thing with Max Roby. So writing a sequel in Everybody's Fool, there are now almost three owners to Sully, because there's my father, who the character was based on, and there was the character that I created, thinking about my old man, and then there's Paul Newman, and so now I'm kind of down to a third ownership of this character, but I look upon Sully in the new book as a kind of collaboration, you know, as opposed to an invention. And the same was true with Philip Seymour Hoffman. I mean, I had no idea whether this book would ever be made into a movie, and if it did, I would have no control over casting, certainly. But in my mind, I was thinking about Philip Seymour Hoffman, and I was probably 250, 300 pages into the writing of Everybody's Fool and seeing Philip in my mind's eye and imagining him playing this character.
Again,
because it was a very small role, but it's a much bigger one in this book, and I was imagining him sinking his teeth into a much more complex character than there was in Nobody's Fool. Thinking about all of this when the word came that Philip had overdosed, and it threw me for, as you might imagine, a considerable loop. Not because I thought there was going to be a movie and that he was going to star in it, but I'd kind of, you know, lost my North Star a little bit in writing his character and thinking about him. And my first thought was, well, since he's not going to play the role, maybe I should try to banish him from my imagination and from his ownership of this character and not be seeing his face every day. But he simply refused to go away. And finally, I just made my peace with it and thought, you know what? All right, it's Philip Seymour Hoffman, and that's what I'll write to. And if I'm very lucky, some other great actor will come in if there's a movie made and make the role his own, and then it'll be another collaboration.
Right. The character of Sully, which Paul Newman played, was based on your father, and I think several of the men in your novels have been based on your father's friends who you spent some time with when you were a boy. And we talked in an earlier interview about how you weren't entirely sure why you kept going back to this world, to your father's world, and giving voice to some of the people from that world who you knew when you were young. Do you have, that was in 2002 when you said that. Do you have a better idea of why you keep going back there now?
Oh, I wish I could say I did. I don't know. There's still questions that I, despite the number of books that I've written, that I still don't know the answers to. And I think that's why I keep returning to my towns in upstate New York, my mill towns in upstate New York. And I just love my parents' generation. I love that World War II generation. I love their optimism. Those men who came back, like my father was a D-Day guy, and those men came back having won the war that we needed most to win, and they came back to their spouses, and they had the GI Bill, and it looked like America would be theirs. It would be there. America was changing right before their eyes, and it was theirs. That's what they felt like. The world, the war that they had won, entitled them to a piece of an America that. And I loved that. I loved their optimism, their sense of a new nation.
So the character of Sully fought in World War II, as did your father. Your character of Sully was on Omaha Beach, and he asked this question at one point in your new novel. Had he gotten off easy? During the war, he'd somehow managed to be standing in the exact right place, while more talented men and better soldiers happened to be standing in the exact wrong one. Often that was right next to Sully. For a while, there on Omaha Beach, there'd been a new, utterly lethal lottery every few seconds. Did you often wonder how surviving affected your father and affected the life he chose to lead, the risks he took, his attitude toward life and death?
I've thought about it a lot. And writing that passage that you just read, of course, I was thinking about my father. My father was one of those guys that didn't talk about the war much, and I had opportunities to ask him about it, and most of those opportunities I neglected. Once or twice I asked him. And what he told me was pretty close to what I just told you, that it had, survival didn't have really an awful lot to do with talent. It had an enormous amount to do with luck. Competence would help you to a certain degree, but it wouldn't get you home. For that, you had to be lucky as well. For my father, who made it from Utah Beach through the Hurtgen Forest and all the way to Berlin, I think it changed his life much as it changed Sully's life. There's an important scene in Everybody's Fool where Sully is talking to Miss Burl, who does not want him to go, and she doesn't want him to go because she says it's going to change him when he comes. She fears that when he comes back, he will be unrecognizable to himself.
And this is his teacher, Miss Burl.
This is Miss Burl, yeah. And he will be unrecognizable to himself. He will lose himself in the sense that he will lose his self. And I think my father came back a changed man. That's what the photographs look like. He was a young, handsome daredevil when he left, and he came back looking distinctly middle-aged, a man who had witnessed horrors. And I think that when he came back from the war, he became a gambler. And I think that sitting down in a little house with a mortgage, with my mother, and then of course I came along to live a suburban life, an ordinary life, was simply unthinkable to him. He needed the tables. He needed to play poker, and he played both sides of the poker table. He was a dealer at times, and also a poker player. And I think the level of excitement, he just had to have it coming back from the war. He just wasn't going to sit down and be a father and a husband.
Which is probably one of the major reasons why your parents divorced when you were young.
Of course.
So finally, I want to ask you about the title of your new book, Everybody's Fool. So it's a sequel to Nobody's Fool. So you knew you wanted to call this Everybody's Fool and have that like title resonance. And you had to have a reason to call it that. And so you actually have Raymer, the police chief, saying at some point, I'm so tired of being everybody's fool. Did you know you had to give some character that line in order to have the title that you needed?
Well, it was nice when it turned up and I had the opportunity to do so. But I'm sitting here in the studio, of course, looking at the cover of my book, which says Everybody's Fool. And there's a name right below that. And it's Richard Russo. So I leave you to contemplate what may or may not be an irony here. I only mention it because it occurred to me.
That's hilarious. I hadn't thought of that. On that note, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry. It's been a joy.
Richard Russo spoke with Terry last Monday. His new novel is called Everybody's Fool. The cartoonist, graphic novelist, and screenwriter Daniel Clowes has been one of the most influential artists in the independent comics world for the past 3 decades. His comics Ghost World and Art School Confidential have been adapted into movies, and Clowes was nominated for an Oscar for co-writing the screenplay for Ghost World. Daniel Clowes has a new comic book, his first in 5 years, called Patience. It's a love story full of tragedy, regret, and time travel. Last year, Fantagraphics released a 2-volume hardcover 25th anniversary edition of Clowes's comic book series, 8-Ball. We're going to hear the onstage interview he recorded with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger at the Free Library of Philadelphia.
So, Dan, your new book is about love and revenge, and the backbone of it is time travel. What inspired you to do something about time travel?
I wanted to use time travel sort of as a metaphor or as a way to kind of explore the idea of going through your life, hitting these little points in your life that are, you know, like a flow chart where you go off in different directions and then something else happens and you go in another direction and then all of a sudden you're way over here when you started here and you're a very different person from what you were there. And so the idea of time travel where you can kind of examine this person that you were back here when you're down the road here and see, like, how the hell did that happen?
Well, thinking about that earlier version of you, I mean, have you thought about whether that person would recognize you now, what they would think about your career?
I think about that a lot. I think, what would I look at myself and go, oh, man, he's bald with a beard. That's so depressing. I would have been sad about that, I think. And I thought, oh, his eyes have gone. You know, I had perfect vision back then.
Well, what about your career?
His posture is still bad.
Well, you sit up a little bit. What about in terms of your career? Would that person...
No, I would have been like, oh, my God. Like, how did that happen? I was expecting to, you know, work for Cracked Magazine for 4 years and then, you know, try to get work putting up aluminum siding or something.
Yeah.
Doing my prison drawings while I was, you know, down for a DUI.
Well, hopefully, I'm glad that things have worked out better than you thought they were going to go.
Yeah.
Well, you've said that you had this dispiriting experience where you'd worked on a book for a year and you're at an author signing event and then someone in line reads it while they're in line and they've finished it.
Oh, yeah. No, with the early comics, you know, they were like 30 pages, and I had many times where, you know, I'd have a line, and I was signing, and I'd see somebody, oh, I'll get one of these and get it signed, and they would be in the line reading it, you know, and they'd get to the end, and it would be like, why do I need this? You know, I'm done with this, and they'd put it back. And I once I was at some event at a comic book store, and I saw a guy come in who was sort of like a superhero guy, and he had dragged his girlfriend in, who obviously didn't care at all about comics. This was many years ago. And she was sort of looking around, and she saw Ghost World, and she said, oh, look at this. And she opens it to the middle, and she starts reading, and she reads all the way to the end. And meanwhile, her boyfriend is, you know, I don't know what he's wasting his time with. And then she gets to the end and she goes, ah. She goes back to the beginning and reads. And then she reads up to the point where she started. And I was like, I've found another reader. And then she just puts it back and walks away. I thought that was That was something I shouldn't have seen.
Well, it's a good thing you've made this one a little heftier than maybe.
That's right. Maybe she should hurt herself trying to put it back.
Jack Barlow, the main character, one of the other main characters in the book, he was traveling through time, and at one point he asked someone at a bar, if you had the chance to kill Hitler's mom, would you do it? And the guy who was watching football, he says, I might after I go break Dan Marine's arm yesterday. So, and a lot of the book is about, part of the book is about personal motivations and versus civic duty when right. you have a certain right. power like this. Why was that interesting to you?
Actually, the reason I put in that line was just sort of an in-joke, was a few years ago I was interviewed for a magazine, a British magazine, one of the big daily papers, and I can't remember which one. And they have a column that's very much like the one that used to be on the back page of the New York Times magazine, you know, where they ask somebody very short questions and have very short answers. And so I did it all by email, and this woman asked me, you know, if you could go back in time, what would you do? And I wrote, if, you know, I'd like to say I would go back and maybe kill Hitler as a baby or find out if Jesus was actually a divine being, but probably I would just go back to my old neighborhood and like look around and, you know, see the kids I grew up with. And I later learned that when they print these in this magazine, they just cut it down to the bare minimum. And so it said, what would you do if you could go back in time? And it goes, I would kill Hitler.
Well, you actually have your character, Jack, go back to his old neighborhood.
Yeah, that's what, after I articulated that, I realized that that's sort of the, that's kind of what the story's about in many ways.
Have you done that yourself?
Oh, yeah. My mom still lives in the same house I grew up in, so it's easy.
Is that an enjoyable experience?
No.
No.
It's fraught with emotional peril, I will say.
But one that, is it edifying in some way?
Oh, yeah. I'm a grown man. I can take it. But it's quite something to see, sort of. It's like, you know, my mom has a lot of stuff in the house, and it's sort of like I can still see my stuff kind of under all the stuff. Like it's like my childhood is preserved under old newspapers
under
and stuff. Yeah.
Do you still have a room there? What's your
room?
Well,
sort of. I mean, there is a room that I used to live in that's now filled with auto parts.
With auto parts?
Yeah. My mom ran a garage in Chicago for years.
But she still has the auto parts.
She has the parts, not the garage.
Not the garage anymore.
My mom is now, she's 86 and she's a lawyer. She got her law degree when she was 76, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, she is an amazing person.
Is she practicing?
Yeah. She does elder law, not surprisingly.
this book, like the last two books you've done, Mr. Wonderful and Wilson, are a lot about people trying to create relationships in their lives, to have some sort of family, and it's sort of more in the domestic sphere. These books are things that you've written since your son was born, is that right?
Yeah, yes.
So what has been interesting you about sort of more of a domestic story?
Well, you know, it's obvious you have no idea how that's going to affect you to have a child. And I resisted having kids for a long time because I was terrified it would affect me. And I thought, I'm going to try to like get through this without having, you know, without even noticing that little brat in the other room. But you know, the minute you're sort of faced with that responsibility, you find out things about yourself that you maybe didn't want to face. You know, you find out what your true opinions are. You know, I find that when I'm talking in front of my son, I find I try to say like what I really feel rather than some version of myself I would have had in my 20s where I had some pose that was just, you know, I want to be contrary because of this various thing. You know, it was much more I want to like I want him to know like what I actually really feel and like what are my real values. And you find yourself kind of really like, do I believe in this? And this is this an actual, you know, opinion of mine, or is this just some masked, you know, thing I'm trying to put out to the world? And so I found it was like very profound in that way, that you know, I sort of became more myself in a certain way. And then you also have that thing of where you know, before that I thought of myself as like, you know, you always think like, I would take a bullet for my best friend or for my wife or something. And then you think like, yeah, if a gun was pointed at me, I'm not sure about that. Like I'd probably be like, you know, it's a, you know, I've got a lot to do here, you know, maybe not me. And then, you know, but the idea of like protecting your child, you really do know, like I would like, you know, carry a bear carcass through the Ozarks and with my teeth to, you know, what it's like, you would just do whatever it took. And it's a very different feeling. And that's sort of the kind of the one-dimensional nature of the guy's quest in this book that was sort of coming out of that.
Do you think that that desire, when you're around your son, to be honest as you can be, has that translated into your work?
I think so, because I think I then just, you know, sort of synthesize that and think, you know, what do I really think?
Fantagraphics recently reprinted in a two-volume set the first 18 issues of 8 Ball.
Yes.
You were very much involved in that. Was it enjoyable to look back at all that work? I mean, I know you've already done it for the show that you were mentioning before, but...
You know, I find there's sort of a lag time. If something is just a few years old, it makes me cringe. You know, I look at it and go, oh my God, this is a disaster. And if it's like 10 years old, I'm sort of, well, it's, you know, I was a young man. And this stuff seems so old, it's like, I was very forgiving of it. And I had to really like look back and go like, well, I worked really hard. You know, I remember working all the time, every day, all day, doing this stuff and trying to learn to do this, you know, do that kind of artwork. And it required like real tenseness on my part, you know, it was very difficult.
What was sort of the most surprising or fun thing about looking back at these issues?
I mean, I was really down on myself during that era. I was really always trying, like, I got to get better. And then looking back on them, I sort of was forgiving myself. I was like, you know, you did a good job. These are pretty good. And they're dense, and they're, you know, I always felt like I gave the readers their money's worth. You know, they were $3 or whatever, and I would kill myself for those issues, you know.
How long would it take to make an issue? I did everything.
I think the comic was supposed to be quarterly, and it was always like 9 months per issue. It's hard to make a living on a $3 comic that came out once a year. But
and you did all the lettering yourself,
too. I did everything. I did everything there could be done.
Do you still letter by hand?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Well, I know a lot of people use computers now.
I don't approve of that. I can tell a mile away, and it always...
Really?
I feel like I'm reading a robot going like, and then I will go.
Well, I thought amazing, too, that you did the lettering, but also the font you used was very elaborate, too. Like, and the narration always had these, I don't know what you call it, but these little flourishes. Yeah, the serifs on it.
Yeah.
That didn't drive you crazy doing this?
I could do it very quickly, yeah.
Really?
I'm a professional.
In your new book, Patience, you get to create a sort of science fiction world. Was that fun to do, to think about what the future might look like?
Yeah, it was less fun than I wanted, because I, you know, when I started, I thought, like, that'll be great to depict the future, and that's always fun to draw, you know, the future world. And then the more I thought about it and was trying to handle it the way I really thought it would be, it was like, the future's not going to be all that interesting. Like, I've got to sort of capture that it will be alien to us, but it will be not, I feel like it won't be as, you know, dystopic and advanced in another 15 years as we all anticipate through most of the science fiction stuff.
Dan predicts that in the future we'll all be wearing fuzzy yellow shirts, so just keep that.
That's
in mind.
Part of it. That's one of the fashion trends that I've invested a lot of money in.
Great. Well, thanks very much.
Thanks.
Daniel Clowes spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Clowes's new comic book is called patience. Pit bulls probably are the most notorious dogs in the U.S. They're associated with dogfighting, attacking people, and serving as guard dogs for drug dealers. Their bite is feared as being more dangerous than the bites of other dogs, and many cities and towns have passed laws making it illegal to own pit bulls. But in the new book, Pit Bull, our next guest, Bronwyn Dickey, says that a lot of the popular beliefs about pit bulls are based on misinformation and myth. In the first half of the 20th century, pit bulls often were cast in films as trick dogs in comic sidekick roles. Luke the Bull Terrier performed tricks and comic stunts in films starring Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, and Fatty Arbuckle. A pit bull co-starred in the Our Gang Little Rascals film comedies. A pit bull starred in the Buster Brown comic strips and films and appeared in the logo for Buster Brown children's shoes. Bronwyn Dickey's book is a history of pit bulls and our changing preconceptions of them. She's the daughter of the late writer James Dickey, who's most famous for his novel Deliverance, which was adapted into the film of the same name. She spoke with Terry last Tuesday.
Bronwyn Dickey, welcome to Fresh Air. So first of all, let's get on the table that you say most dogs that we think of as pit bulls probably aren't pit bulls. Why is there so much confusion about what kind of dog is actually a pit bull? What's officially a pit bull? And that's important to know, because if you have all these stereotypes about pit bulls, and if in some cities and towns pit bulls, you're not even allowed to have a pit bull, it's important to know, well, what is a pit bull?
Right. And that's the biggest misconception, is that the term pit bull refers to one distinct breed, when really it refers to at least four pedigreed breeds of dogs, and then all these other dogs that get lumped into the category. So you have the American Pit Bull Terrier, you have the American Staffordshire Terrier, the Staffordshire Bull Terrier, and a newer breed called the American Bully. But increasingly, because those dogs are kind of generic looking and they share these characteristics with at least 25 other breeds of dogs, such as smooth coats or blocky heads, then anything becomes a pit bull. And so the category just grows and grows and grows. And when people ask, well, why are there so many pit bulls in the news? It's because at this point, almost anything is considered a pit bull.
So there are a lot of commonly held beliefs about pit bulls. Let me ask you about a couple of them. One is that they're natural fighters and they're hardwired to kill. Is that true?
No. There's absolutely no credible scientific evidence of that. You have specific subpopulations that have been used over time in the illegal pursuit of dogfighting, but they really can't be held up as the standard for all pit bulls in America. That would be like using the Navy SEALs as a standard for all American men. There's no evidence at all that this entire huge group of dogs, that there's anything different about them whatsoever.
Okay. But people believe that their bite is more lethal because once they bite, their jaws kind of like lock. So like you are in the teeth of that dog, and it's a stronger and more longly held bite.
Yeah, that's not true at all. And once again, there's no credible scientific evidence to that. All the evidence we have shows that the biggest determinant of a dog's bite strength is actually its body mass and not its breed.
So like the bigger the dog, the
yes.
The worse the bite?
The bigger the dog, yes.
But weren't pit bulls initially bred to be fighters?
Yes, that is true. The original American Pit Bull Terrier that started in 1889 in Massachusetts, it was originally a fighting dog, yes.
So wasn't it kind of bred to have fighting abilities?
Well, fighting abilities are extremely complicated and rare. So the dogfighting investigators that I've spoken with over the years who've studied this, who've studied hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these dogs, and some have even gone undercover as dogfighters themselves, they stress to me that if one dog in a litter, and this is a litter that has been actively selected for these certain traits, if one dog in a litter actually possesses the traits necessary to be a fighter, then that's considered a very high success rate. So fighting is not just one static thing, it's a whole suite of very complex behaviors, and each one of those is different, and each dog will or will not display those at a different level.
When the American Pit Bull Terrier was bred to be a fighting dog in Massachusetts in the late 1800s, what were dog fights like then compared to what dog fights are like now?
My understanding, at least from the historical literature, is they were tamer. And I use that kind of hesitantly because no matter what you're talking about, this is the torture of animals. But they were shorter. They were not as bloody and brutal. Dogs did not die very often. And in fact, it was kind of rare for a dog to die in the pit. And then in the kind of 70s and 80s and today, things got much more brutal. But
and more amped up, right? With like steroids,
yes,
and amphetamines.
Yes, exactly. With drugs, cattle prods, things just kind of reached a new level of sadism.
So it's interesting how, as you put it, the pit bull went from America's mascot to a symbol of like the fighting dog. And, it was like the dog on the RCA logo and the dog in the Buster Brown logo and the dog in our gang, you know, in the series of short films. So what changed and when did it change to make the image of the pit bull like the fighting dog, the guard dog, the vicious dog?
Right. Well, there's always been a kind of subset of people who didn't like the dogs because of what they represented. And it is, again, it is true that they did originate as fighting dogs. But throughout the 19th century, they were increasingly bred as pets and kept as pets by predominantly people in the working class. And so the dog with the patch over his eye became kind of this branding symbol of tenacity and American fortitude and individualism. And then in the 1950s, there was more of a push for more genteel pedigree dogs, dogs like Labrador Retrievers and Golden Retrievers and Irish Setters that were more associated with kind of the genteel lifestyle that went more with what American families in the 1950s were trying to cultivate. And then you had the 60s and 70s. There was a time of much more social upheaval. And there was a very well-intentioned move by the humane movement to eradicate what was left of professional dogfighting because it was growing so brutal and sadistic. And because they operated in different states, they were very hard to catch. So in order to make that crime a felony, the humane movement enlisted the help of the media, and there was this kind of media blitz to bring dogfighting to the forefront of the American mind and make people care. And so people started reading stories about these dogs called pit bulls that had these supposedly horrific characteristics.
So you think the pit bulls were demonized instead of the people who were training them and fighting
yes.
them?
Yes. They were almost presented as though they were kind of willing participants in their own torture.
You suggest in your book that you think a lot of racism was projected onto pit bulls because they became popular in African-American urban communities, not just as fight dogs and guard dogs, but just as popular dogs. So in what ways do you think that like race entered into perceptions of pit bulls?
I think especially when kind of the stories about them started to spiral out of control in the late 70s and then into the Reagan 80s, they became kind of proxies for a lot of the racial tensions that were brewing in America. And I think as people felt these tensions, yet it was increasingly unpopular to voice them out loud about other groups of people, I think gradually those just got shunted onto the dogs. And so the dogs became proxies for human prejudice, really. Because when the dogs were kind of working class, average Joe, all-American dogs in the 1920s, that was one thing. But when the dogs became associated with the urban poor, then there was this move to ban them and to eradicate them and to portray them. As we know, I mean, you think about kind of Hillary Clinton's unfortunate super predator comment, the dogs were also called super predators.
Let's talk a little bit about dogs in your life. Your father is the late writer James Dickey. Your mother was, I think, his second wife, and he was a heavy drinker. She had become a drug addict. You had 9 dogs growing up, and you're right, none of them lived with us longer than a few years. Most roamed the neighborhood, where one was hit by a car, some were chained in the backyard, where one strangled and died. All of them howled long into the night, and because of all this, your neighbors viewed you all with contempt and thought of you as being irresponsible in terms of how you treated your dogs. So what was your relationship to dogs growing up with these 9 different dogs who neighbors thought your parents treated irresponsibly?
I always wanted to have close relationships with dogs when I was young. And I think I watched a lot of television. I watched Lassie. I looked at my neighbors and their children and the relationships they had with their pets, and that was something I wanted very badly. But because there was so much chaos in my family, that was very, very hard to have. And I think that kind of alerted me early on to the fact that love is one thing, but life is very complicated and people have a lot of layers to them. And just because you might not be able to provide for an animal in the way you'd like to doesn't necessarily mean you don't love it. And I saw that a lot when I was reporting out in the streets, looking at people with their pit bulls, for sure.
Why did your parents want so many dogs? I assume they didn't have 9 at one time, but that...
No.
That they were...
No, I think probably for me. I really loved animals, and I think sometimes they probably bought me a puppy here and there because it was something that I really wanted. But the dogs just got lost in a very tumultuous and chaotic family cycle.
So were these child-friendly dogs?
Yes, very much so. Even despite their hard and deprived existences, they were all wonderful.
You write that you were 6 when your mother told you she had a drug problem. You were 9 when your mother was arrested for cocaine possession. You were 12 when your father's liver failed from years of drinking, and 15 when he died of liver failure. How did they take care of you when you were young if they couldn't take care of the dogs?
That's a good question. They did the best they could. And I think that's really all I can say. They did the best they could. I never felt that I was unloved at all. And fortunately, we had the financial resources, which many American families don't have, that I was always looked out for by someone at some point. But my parents, just because they had problems doesn't mean they were bad people. And just because they couldn't provide certain levels of care, whether, you know, it was for our pets or even for me, it certainly doesn't mean they were bad. They were just complicated, and their lives were very chaotic and troubled.
At some point, Christopher, who was the son of your father's first marriage, intervened and arranged for you to attend boarding school. Was that helpful for you?
It was. My parents had separated at that point, and I was 14, and I think he saw that my father didn't have much time left and wanted me to be in a place that was safe and relatively stable when my father passed away. So yes, that provided a level of structure that I really needed at that point in my life.
And I should mention that in addition to James Dickey's poems and novels, what he's probably most famous for is writing Deliverance, which was adapted into the film with Burt Reynolds and Ned Beatty. There was a long stretch of his life, you say, during which he believed that nothing really counted but his great poetic project. What was that project?
His desire to create and surpass his own talent, I guess, to keep striving for poetry that could attain something he previously thought unattainable. And so everything for, I would say, probably for most of the 70s, everything in his life was devoted to that. And unfortunately, I don't think he cared much who he alienated during that time in his life.
Does that include you? Did you feel like you came in second to the great poetic project?
No. And that was what was really interesting about my upbringing versus Chris's, in that by the time I was born in 1981, a lot of that had kind of burned itself out. And he was very, very present for me as a father in terms of his attention, in terms of reading to me, spending time with me, listening to my questions, teaching me to ask others. He was very, very devoted in a way that he unfortunately wasn't for Chris and my brother Kevin. Or he was for Chris early on, but then kind of the deliverance fame shoved that to the side a bit.
Yeah, and I should mention your brother Chris is Christopher Dickey, who was a longtime Newsweek correspondent and is now often seen on MSNBC, has an international affairs blog. He's covered the Islamic world for a long time, is based in France. So did your father, James Dickey, make writing seem like torture or like something really wonderful?
For him, it was wonderful. It was difficult, but it was wonderful. He got up at 6 a.m., played guitar every morning, and then went straight to his typewriter. And he always instilled in me the idea that if you work hard enough at it, things will get so much better. He would take a poem through perhaps 100 drafts if he had to, but he always put the work in. He did not believe in what he called the Mozartian flights of the imagination. Not to say he didn't believe in talent, but he worked at his writing every day and he worked very hard, but he never felt that writing was a burden and he never conveyed that to me.
Since your family dogs had several misfortunes and since your parents weren't considered to be very responsible owners of those dogs, how old were you when you felt like you could get a dog and take care of it well?
I was 21. And for a long time, I think it was kind of a really powerful statement as to how much I carried that shame with me, that I didn't really feel I deserved the love or companionship of a dog until I was probably 21 years old. And even then, it was filled with a lot of doubt and fear and worry that somehow I would screw things up or that I wouldn't do a good job. And so I really felt so much for the people I met while reporting this story, the kids that I saw out in the neighborhoods who so wanted that relationship with a dog and just didn't have the right resources to be able to have it. It really kind of pulled at my heart pretty strong.
Bronwyn Dickey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bronwyn Dickey is the author of the new book, Pitbull. She spoke with Terry last Tuesday. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.